and welcome to another episode of Banking Matters. Today, I am extremely excited to join along with Brett Goodnack here for a special episode welcoming Brett to the table. Brett is actually a coworker of mine. He works on the Compliance Hub with me on the advisory hotline alongside a team of other attorneys and bankers here at Compliance Alliance. Brett is an attorney and he has extensive BSA experience. So we are extremely excited to have Brett join us to talk through some recent BSA developments. Brett, welcome.
Thank you so much, Elizabeth. I am thrilled to be here, here being my basement office, but virtually with you. I'm very excited to be joining you this afternoon.
I know we have a lot of bankers who are puzzling a little bit over recent BSA developments, especially some of the FAQs that dropped recently. So I was hoping if we could maybe start with your analysis of those FAQs and how they might be impacting banks. And then maybe if we have time, we can get into some of the other recent developments.
Yeah, absolutely. So the FAQs you're alluding to, I believe, are the recent SAR FAQs, the Suspicious Activity Report FAQs that FinCEN issued earlier in the month, actually just like a week and a half ago on October 9th. And I really appreciate FinCEN as a bureau because they issue FAQs, in my opinion, as much or more so than any other agency on a lot of tricky topics that bankers have questions on a lot. Famously, the beneficial ownership information reporting earlier this year and late last year, they had a slew of FAQs on, but they have FAQs on all of their required reporting. So your CTRs, your currency transaction reports, your SARs, they have a more robust FAQ than the one I'll cover. But they also have CDD, customer due diligence FAQs, a BSA, a large one that kind of touches on every little aspect of it. And they're constantly issuing advisories and other items of guidance. So I do appreciate that. And I do think that it's all a good faith effort to get clarification to reduce burdens on banks. And that's specifically what this FAQ states its intention was. It said it was informed by feedback from banks to reduce burden of filing. Mm-hmm. And I believe that too. But first, I want to cover what the FAQs actually state, what they purport to clear up. And then I want to get into a little bit, if I can. I'm already just blabbering on, but if I can, I want to talk about what I've noticed. If you dig in a little deeper and you have any sort of BSA knowledge, or I mean, if you've ever filed a SAR, you probably have picked up on the fact that these FAQs, at least three of them to be precise, probably present some contradictions, maybe even outright changes to existing guidance, specifically within the FFIEC exam manual, which is what examiners use when they're looking at a bank's program. So it's noteworthy at the least, but starting at the beginning, what better place to start? The FAQ itself is four questions and answers. And the first one centers around structuring. Basically, it restates an existing BSA law. It is also important to point out, I guess, before I get too far into this, and I'll pull up the actual language of the FAQ so that I'm not mincing words. Much like other guidance FinCEN has recently put out, and this is an interagency effort, I should also mention that, they specifically say these answers to these FAQs do not alter existing BSA legal or regulatory requirements or establish new supervisory expectations. And you'll see later why that's kind of ironic at the very least.
It's posing some questions for banks. We can put it that way.
yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah. But they're trying to say, hey, we're not saying you're required to do anything new. This is all existing law. So that first FAQ has to do with structuring. And it basically is saying a bank has to file a SAR only if they know, suspect, or have reason to suspect that a transaction is structured to evade reporting. Merely having a transaction that's hovering around the triggering threshold, the 10,000 mark for a CTR, keep in mind those are separate thresholds and separate requirements, isn't automatically enough to file a SAR. You need more than that. Their goal purportedly is to refocus the filing on what's genuinely suspicious and not just something driven off of volume. I get that. I think that's pretty altruistic. I also think that could be effective. I don't really have any problems with that one. Not that I'm some arbiter of what is good also, because I don't think I could write an FAQ. I also don't know how they do this, but that one was clean in my book.
So basically where we start saying, to get, if there's not evidence of structuring, you don't have to file a SAR just because you had a below threshold transaction, below a CTR threshold.
That's dead on, Elizabeth. Yeah. They basically say, I mean, you could, if you're a lazy reader like me, you could basically get it after the first sentence. It says the mere presence of a transaction or series of transactions by or behalf of the same person at or near $10,000 CTR threshold is not information sufficient to require the filing of a SAR.
So structuring SARs are still a thing if you have evidence of structuring.
Okay. Yes. Yes.
Seems pretty straightforward.
Yeah. I mean, it reiterates that attempting to evade CTR, that is suspicious activity.
Yep.
And that may be indicative of underlying illegal activity. But just because you have a transaction around $10,000, that in and of itself isn't enough to trigger a SAR.
Okay.
So moving on to the second two, they both have to do with continuing activity SARs. One with the form, the first with reviews of continuing activity, the second more to do with the timeline for filing and reviews. The first clarifies that banks aren't required to perform separate post-SAR reviews every 90 days to check for ongoing suspicious activity. And they use the phrase that institutions can rely on risk-based monitoring instead of automatic re-reviews. So this, and we'll touch on this a little bit, this almost is kind of a shift away from the manuals every 90 days expectation, for lack of a better word. But the effort here is also pretty clear in my eyes. They look to be reducing burden. You could argue repetitive reviews, just putting your attention elsewhere on other suspicious activity. That would be, if I was the one who wrote this, that would be my argument for it. And then similarly, just because they're so linked, the third FAQ is the timeline. It reaffirms that continuing activity SARs need not be filed every 90 days, extending the example timeline to 150 days, but emphasizing that filing should occur as appropriate under a bank's own risk-based approach. Now, again, we'll touch on this in a moment, but it presents a little bit of ambiguity because it leaves open when continuing activity actually warrants another suspicious activity report. And there's just an uneasiness between the dates or the timeline in the manual currently versus what this is saying. It suggests that maybe the manual should be updated because they're not going to redact this. So the last FAQ is the one that I have the biggest gripe with because I think it just flies in the face of why SARs exist in the first place for a myriad of reasons. Again, I'm no tastemaker. I could be dead wrong, but the fourth SAR FAQ has to do with the documentation of kind of a no-call. When banks decide not to file a SAR, this FAQ says there's no regulatory requirement to document a decision not to file a SAR. It remains optional. You can do it. And it should match whatever the bank's SIP, CDD, AML, BSA policies and procedures are. It should be driven by risk. That's BSA's bread and butter. Everything should be driven by risk. And I can see once again why they're saying this, because it would, you got to put a lot of time and effort if you're saying why you didn't do something. I mean, when you're trying to affirm the negative, it's kind of hard to do. Saying why you didn't do something does take time and effort. And I can see why they said this. But now I think we can get into why we're seeing some contradictions with these FAQs and what actually is in the manual. And maybe I'll work backwards, reverse order, starting with this one. The decision to not file a SAR is probably the most directly contradictory to what is currently in the exam manual. I'm going to read again, if you give me 1 second to pull up.
Yeah, I was going to say, I bet you have that quote in front of you, don't you, Brett?
Yeah.
Because it's in black and white. And
yeah, exactly right, Elizabeth. Like you when you can go to verbatim language, then you know you have
chapter
kind
and verse.
Of a problem on your hands. And it says it two different places within the manual, too. So first, it talks about from kind of the investigators, boots on the ground perspective. It says external research tools may include widely available internet media search tools, as well as those accessible by subscription. After thorough research and analysis, investigators should document conclusions, including any recommendation regarding whether or not to file a SAR. But then perhaps the more damning language is the decision maker, and this is under the subcategory of SAR decision making, an appropriate place. The decision maker, whether an individual or committee, should have the authority to make the final SAR filing decision. When the bank uses a committee, there should be a clearly defined process to resolve differences of opinion on filing decisions. Here's where it gets tricky. Banks should document SAR decisions, including the specific reason for filing or not filing a SAR. Thorough documentation provides a record of the SAR decision-making process, including final decisions not to file a SAR. However, due to the variety of systems used to identify, track, and report suspicious activity, as well as the fact that each suspicious activity reporting decision will be based on unique facts and circumstances, no single form of documentation is required when a bank decides not to file. So it does allude to the fact that you don't have to, but it does strongly set the expectation that you should document every instance where you are faced with triggering criteria, and that's also listed in the exam manual, and you make that decision not to file. Now, why I say I think this is particularly problematic is I think it goes against why a SAR exists. I mean, I know that it's trying to reduce a burden, but the SAR is widely known as a discretionary filing. I mean, it gives a lot of decision making and the power to create a narrative to the bank. But at the end of the day, it is to give data to FinCEN and law enforcement with the ultimate goal of combating financial crime. Yeah. So I would argue just as important as the cases where there was suspicious activity, you learn a lot from those borderline cases where a decision to not file was made as well. I think you lose a lot of visibility when you don't document things like this. How I said it earlier, BSA's bread and butter is risk. So when you lose some kind of evidence of risk judgments from the bank, I mean, that's really valuable data. You don't see how the process evolves within the bank, how their risk judgments grow or are adaptive to the specific risks. You don't know necessarily if it's working when you don't have the decisions not to file.
It's a way of assessing the program and the strength of the BSA, the SAR committee, or whoever's making those decisions. To me, it's kind of parallel. Like I filed SARs before, but my primary work was doing loan reviews, and we documented a clean loan review the same way we documented a loan review that had errors or violations in it, because documenting the clean reviews tells part of the story about the overall compliance management program. To me, that's kind of a parallel. not documenting the non-files seems like we're missing a big puzzle piece in the robust picture of the BSA monitoring.
Yeah.
Correct me if I'm wrong on that.
No, I couldn't agree more, Elizabeth. And I think that's a fantastic parallel. I think that specifically also hits on another point, maybe even more so, about accountability. I mean, when you're not showing your homework or your work, as it were, you're kind of deflecting your responsibility away, like I don't know. It's hard to articulate exactly what I'm trying to say, but you're taking away a lot of the pressure on yourself to be held accountable by your own standards. You have policies in place to make these decisions, so you should be held to those both ways. And I think that...
And we're talking just these SARs that reached a triggering point that they needed to be examined and then they weren't filed. So I shouldn't say SARs. We're talking the situations that did not become filed SARs. We're not like clearing the daily alerts, reviewing things. You've got good justification that this was a false positive, any of that stuff. That's just daily monitoring work. My understanding is this is talking when there was a situation concerning enough that it was reviewed, but then it wasn't filed. Is that correct?
Right, exactly. Okay. Yes. Okay. Spot on once more. Yeah, it's like I keep using the phrase like triggering thresholds. It's one of those criteria that would require a SAR. It's floating around that. It triggers an investigation, like you just said. And you're looking for patterns. You're looking for red flags. It's all risk-driven. It's what it's all about. So the absence of SARs, especially those that you reviewed and then made that affirmative decision to say we're not filing, is just as important as the ones that you do file, because where you see a bank repeatedly saying, well, we're not filing on this, that could even show, you know, deficiencies or blind spots too. So
yeah, like I was gonna say, like, no one wants to get in trouble during an exam, but sometimes those audits or even the exams are good health checkups when someone, an auditor or an examiner, says, you know what, we kind of think you should have filed on this one. Nobody wants to hear those words, but it's not necessarily a bad thing to hear those words about one SAR rather than 5 years down the road having a deep dive into your SARs and finding out that there was serious deficiencies in your program and they all should have been filed. So having that documentation to show where your decision-making is working, in case somebody wants to come in and say, you know what, I think maybe we need to tweak your decision-making at the bank level, I personally think that's a good health checkup, but maybe that's just me.
No, I'm on your side on that one too. I think we're simpatico with this. Not to get belabored by just the one FAQ.
Carry on, Brett.
rapidly running out of time. Just to at least say that I covered my other gripes with the FAQ. The other two have to do with the continuing activity SARs, the reviews and the timeline. So that second FAQ basically said banks are not required to conduct a separate review after filing a SAR to determine whether suspicious activity has continued. They can rely on their general risk-based monitoring as part of their day-to-day operations. But the manual says the bank should continue to review and file SARs on ongoing suspicious activity every 90 to 120 days and reassess whether to terminate relationships or take actions. The BSA manual suggests for a bank's ongoing monitoring obligations that they should be event-driven, which is more in line with what the FAQs are saying. But the manual also does say for these continuing SARs, there is this expectation. So the FAQ actually is softening what has been treated as an established expectation. I'd say it's more than a best practice, but less than a requirement. And unless the manual is updated, you're going to have banks that are actually getting confused by what's supposed to clarify a concept. Inconsistencies are always going to be confusing.
And confusion raises risk. That's the concern. I think what I'm seeing some bankers concerned about is if these FAQs are taken as cool, there's a little bit of kind of a deregulation slant to these. Some banks might welcome that. But the concern that you are raising is that the examination handbook has not actually been updated yet. Is that kind of the crux of the matter? Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. that I'm wondering if I could shift should shift gears. No, I'll cover my last one, and if we have time, I would the last thing is the timeline for continuing activity. I'll blitz through this. The SAR filing timeline via the FAQ starts at day zero, and that in the FAQ is defined as the detection of facts that may constitute suspicious activity, which to me implies that the 30-day clock begins as soon as an alert or referral occurs. Okay. The manual, on the other hand, says initial detection occurs only after the institution has reviewed and determined that the activity is suspicious. So the 30-day or 60-day clock actually begins once a determination is made. So it's a redefinition of what initial detection actually is. And effectively, it shortens the timeline that a bank has to investigate before filing, which, you know, there's this, again, expectation idea of a reasonable period of time. Now you're going the other way. Now you're shortening it. It's just, again, confusion. It's going to lead to risk. The reason I wanted to talk about all of that in a kind of a high level is this idea on FinCEN's resource page, when they talk about their regulatory releases, and that's their advisories, their proposed rules, their opinions, their guidance, etc. They talk about this idea of persuasive precedent. I don't know how much.
We're fine for time, Brett, and I value your feedback so much. So please carry on and give us your thoughts on this. I am appreciating this so much.
I thank you very much, Elizabeth. I am a jabberjaw, and I apologize. I'll get through this very, very quickly. So on that page, they say such interpretations of regulation issued pursuant to the BSA that are published on FinCEN's public website under the heading guidance, which FAQs would be, shall have persuasive precedential effect, and to that extent may be relied upon by those financial institutions subject to the specific provision of 31 CFR Chapter X, the BSA, being interpreted until such interpretation is superseded, revoked, or amended. So we've seen a trend of FinCEN recently putting out a lot of this kind of guidance that is not, and I said it way, way back, but it makes a specific point of saying we're not creating new rules here. These are existing regulations. These are existing requirements. We're just clarifying. So although they're not formally binding, these non-binding FAQs and advisories and letters are actually functioning as de facto rules when they say things that are different than what you see in the manual, because the examiners are still going to look at them. They might even cite them if they're looking at them during an exam cycle. Banks are going to treat them as rules because they're looking them and interpreting them as, well, this came directly from FinCEN, so we don't want to get some kind of slap on the wrist for not following what they said. And unless the manual changes to match it, then they're in this position where, well, it has this kind of persuasive precedent, so we better follow it. It's a good idea in concept, and I mean, truly all the agencies operate this way. But yeah, when you have contradictions, it puts banks in a real precarious position.
So if I'm understanding it, banks can continue the way they have currently been going following the manual guidance. Like, there's nothing in these FAQs that say banks have to change their practices.
That's exactly right. Okay. Yeah. I mean, anytime you see that thing that says this doesn't change the rules, you might champion this phrase as well, Elizabeth, but the exam manuals are like taking a test when you have the answers in front of you.
An open book test. Why would you not read those manuals?
Right on. So banks, I mean, still follow what's in the manuals, because until that changes, you know the rules.
For banks wanting to take advantage of potential leniency that these FAQs offer, It sounds like there is some leg to stand on because of that precedent language saying that the FAQs might potentially basically overrule what's in the exam manual. The trouble is we can't really say for sure. Is that kind of the crux of the matter, or do I have that wrong?
No. I would say that's a pretty fair assessment of the whole shebang. It's because it has that persuasive precedential effect. They're almost encouraged to treat it as, their prerogative to follow and feel safe in doing so. But at the same time, as we just spoke about, where it does contradict with the manuals, that's going to cause a little bit of confusion. And if they had to pick between one, I don't know which they would do. I guess they're in the right if they pick either one, because they have something to fall back on, right? I don't know. It's confusing. I'm confused. Are you confused? We're all confused.
Brett. What is takeaway advice you would give to banks? I mean, given that we cannot make a bank's decision for them, it has to be based on their risk appetite, their preferences, their procedures, and also simply the markets they're working in. BSA is so driven by a bank's activities, its geographic location, all that stuff. What is advice you would give as a rule of thumb for how banks should approach these FAQs?
It's a great question, actually. My advice for things like this, similar to when other guidance or even executive orders come out, until you have what you consider to be the definitive rule updated. So here, until you have the FFIEC, BSA, AML manual updated, or until the FAQs and the manual are reconciled to match, you should follow what is the established rule. You should always go with what is the established rule. And short of that, always document your decisions. Always have the most thorough documentation of why you did what you did.
Except maybe when it comes to not filing a SAR.
When you have a no decision on a SAR, then I guess do whatever you want. I would say that go with what the manual says when in doubt. But if you are going to quote unquote take advantage of the leniency that the FAQs purport to provide, then I would just document your decisions accordingly.
I think that is really, really helpful advice, because the analysis you've given here helps provide that bedrock of understanding why you're then giving the advice you just gave. But we are getting bankers asking about this. You and I both work on the hotline, and we know that bankers are concerned when guidance like this comes out, because they want to know hard and fast rules. How do we implement this? How do we explain this to management? What effect does this have on our banks? And what I hear you kind of saying is potentially maybe not a lot of effect, unless the bank wants to make a risk-based decision that they're going to embrace these FAQs, but then they really need to document their reasoning and how their programs are going to evolve. Is that fair to say?
I think that's very well said.
Okay. Brett, I appreciate this analysis so much. I read those FAQs. I puzzled over them. I did not have the level of granular analysis that you've given us, and this has helped me. I am sure it is going to help the bankers listening in. I appreciate this so much. When you share your BSA wisdom with us, we all sit and learn. It's just such a pleasure to hear you talk BSA and to give your guidance on this.
Well, first of all, it's my pleasure, but you're using some pretty lofty language. I wouldn't call it wisdom. It's trivia, if nothing else. It's honestly, it's been very fun and great talking with you this afternoon. I'll talk about the BSA all the live long day. So don't get me started, because you see what happens.
Yeah. No, we appreciate it so much. Any final words you'd like to give to our listeners?
Have a happy Halloween. No, I got nothing.
Thank you so much for your time, Brett. Like I said, the way you have summarized this has been very helpful to me, giving some clarity to these FAQs, kind of helping give some guidance to banks how they might want to approach these. I appreciate your time so much. Thank you for sharing your knowledge. Thank you for sharing your insights. To all our listeners, thank you for tuning in. This has been another episode of Banking Matters. It was our pleasure to host Brett Goodnack today, and we hope you will tune in next time.